would be very much in favor of this. And I think it doesn't need to be just about integration. You know, we could have that be potentially sort of the culmination, like maybe have the final talk talking about that. But laying out, you know, I think initial findings across this, I think would work very well. Do you think it's necessary, or do you think it's okay to have everybody be from this consortium? Do you feel like do we need to bring in anyone up from outside, or what do you think,
Michael? I think it should be. In terms of a title, something along the lines of brain, face, and behavior in FASD, mm-hmm. connecting the dots.
Mm-hmm.
I would put CFAS in there as we've tried to do with every symposium.
Mm-hmm. Of course.
If we have one of the four talks from outside, I can't see that there'd be any problem with that.
Is there any advantage to it, I guess, is what I was wondering. Is there any reason that's a good thing? I don't know.
I'm not sure. You know, the sorts of things that I had in mind exactly what you've just articulated, which is, you know, we could have talks that integrate them, maybe, you know, we'll hear what Kathy has to say today, but along the lines of the PLOS One paper, which was a nice brain face intersection and had really interesting results. We could have a brain one, a behavior one, and then to do the grand correlation.
Mm-hmm.
And so if people are interested in doing this, maybe speak up now, and I'd be happy to organize this again. But just need to get a sense of what types of ideas that you have and how we could do this. I think the goal here, again, is to take some of the data that we've now gathered and to bring it together across domains. We can highlight the importance of that by having talks that independently speak to some of those correlations in different model systems, but that, you know, culminate in the human data and its integration. So I'm open to any ideas, and I'm happy to put it together, but would need everybody's input and participation.
So, Sarah, I don't know if this is the kind of thing you're looking for, but I also think I'd like to work a little bit longer to make sure it's going to work out, but we've been working on our hierarchical classification using dysmorphology and behavior, and right now it's looking very good. It's far from done, but I don't know if that's something. So the goal is to improve our ability to identify kids using both dysmorphology and behavior. It's similar to things that we've talked about before. We're trying to, you know, get down to the smallest possible number of variables and really improve our classification. But I don't know, Michael, if that's the kind of thing you're looking for.
I think it is.
It is, exactly. And because, you know, it both is directed at accomplishing the goals of CFAS, including better diagnosis, and it does involve some integration of domains, dysmorphology, face, and behavior.
Okay. I'd like to spend a little bit more time. There's nothing worse than saying you're going to do something and then, you know, the results don't come out. I want to spend a little more time looking at it, but I know we have a little bit more time, too.
We actually have time, and I think the good thing about it is it's what we all wanted to do. So if we put it down, it is the forward pass that we have to catch ourselves.
Yep, that's true. Mm-hmm. I agree.
So I think it's exactly what we want.
Mm-hmm. Okay, I'm in.
From the brain perspective, that you think you can do in that time, and is it something that needs to parallel something that I do during that time for the principal components thing?
I don't think so. I mean, I think is there anything that you want to report? I mean, so I don't think it has to be, all of it has to be data reduction. I don't know that it needs to be. I think if you've got interesting findings, and you could do it in the context of a high dimensionality data, which is what you have from the brain. And I think that would be totally what we'd be looking for. So I think if you had anything that you wanted to report in terms of brain findings, I think that would be exactly what we'd want to have. I just think, in essence, everything that we do is multidimensional. So that's my thing.
You
disagree, Michael?
No, absolutely.
Jeff, do you have any ideas? Have you been doing cool stuff that might?
Well, they're still working on the functional connectivity stuff, which I don't think that we are going to have ready by December, unfortunately.
Could you describe what you're going to talk about? You don't actually have to have the exact results, but have a broad sense of it. Would you have that?
Probably not at this point, no. I mean, there's a lot of methodological things, and I don't yet know how it's going to come out.
Okay, all right.
I didn't mean to put you on the spot. It's just, we could pull together stuff that we've been working on. I'm not sure we'd have time to do a super high-dimensional thing, but who knows, maybe.
Well, let me just rephrase what I was saying. So the thing, and tell me if you're thinking the same way, Michael. I mean, every domain that we're talking about here has dimensionality just in itself. So if you think about the assessment of cognition, I mean, the number of domains, I mean, just the sheer amount of data, large data problems, I think, in that question. You have that in that. You have it in brain imaging. You have it in the face. All three areas inherently already are large data questions. And then the question is, how do you take these incredibly rich and informative data sets and put them together given the complexity that each has already? And I think, so it's almost like you have three presentations, and your fourth is, how do we put these all together? Because that's what we need to be doing, is having them inform each other. So I think the link between them is, in essence, high dimensionality and large data question. I don't know what you think about that, Michael, but that's, you're addressing it individually in each presentation and then putting it all together in what I would think would be the final presentation. So I think that is a common theme across all domains that we're talking about.
I agree. I think that sounds just fine. So we would need a sort of a face-centered, a brain-centered, and a behavior-centered one with a culminating talk that does the integration. And it sounds like Sarah is willing to do the dysmorphology behavior one, representing behavior, and Elizabeth could do something in brain. So we need something from face and something that integrates them. And Tatiana, you've been involved in some of the integration data, and so has Peter. How would you divide those out?
I think Peter has to decide what way he wants to do that. I would defer to him first.
So, Peter, what are your thoughts?
Well, we can, obviously we can do a separate face one, but I think we could also do face brain to some extent. I don't know how many people you want to present. I mean,
you want to have
just
four.
On face.
Four. We could do, it sounds like we would have Sarah or someone from her group and Elizabeth or someone from her group for the first two, and then we need in the last two something that involves face more directly, but could be integrated, and something that could even be a grander integration of all three. For the people who aren't on the call, we looking at gene by alcohol exposure correlations with certain genes that were suggested from work in my lab, and found certain correlations with face, brain, and behavior. And in doing that, Tatiana put together, it wasn't shared in this particular meeting, but a very large grid that looked at relationships among some of those principal components and found significant correlations also. And so...
So what we could do, let me ask you this, Michael, we could do face, which would, I think, if we're doing face, I think that totally makes sense that Peter, that has to be, you or if you want Mike to do it, I think it has to be one of the two of you. What we could do for the final one is, again, bring in genetics, and that might be a nice logical thing. I think it's going to require coordination among all of us in terms of how we want to do some multivariate phenotypes. So if it's in the context of genetics, I'm a lot more comfortable doing that, but I think it's clearly going to involve all of us working on that together. How do you feel about that, Peter?
I like the idea of bringing in the genetics as well, I must say. But okay. Would it repeat the other workshop too much?
Well, I think what we may have by June, and I think we will because we're talking now about sending out samples, is we'll have a lot more genetic data than we have right now. So we're going to have probably at least 300 more people that we're going to have genetic data on. So I think the things that we could do, I mean, we can provide as our preliminary data what we have now, but by June we should have that additional data as well. And so I think we could also bring that in, and I think that would all be new then. It would be a larger sample.
Is there a way to figure out which pieces will be have genes, brain, behavior, and face? Like,
I don't know that I'd say specific genes. I think I'd avoid doing that because I think by the time you double the sample size, what you have now might be different than what you have then. So I think I'd be a little cautious about doing it. But I think we could certainly give the flavor of it in the abstract and give ourselves some flexibility. I think we could.
So my question was, of the samples that are being run right now, do we know how many of them have brain, face, and neurocog? Does that make sense?
No, it does. So it's all prioritized. So as you know, that's why we've been sort of we don't have as many from your site. So I think that's partly why Leah was pushing to try to get a visit there. So I think we were trying to get numbers up at your site. But we have pretty good Leah's got it broken up, and I can send it out after this call. So for the 300 people we're talking about doing it, it grabs everybody from whom we would have saliva and a brain image, everybody that has saliva and cognition. I can definitely tell you who has all three domains, and I can give you the number out of that 300. I can give it to you. I don't have it right here, but I can get it to you after the call.
Okay,
but it's
yeah,
prioritized to basically get everybody. That's our goal, is to get them all sent off.
Okay.
So in terms of action items, what I would ask is if each person could put together a paragraph for me in the format of the abstract that – you could copy the other people who are going to participate in this so that we can sort of refine that, and maybe in the next week or two to have something that everybody has seen so that they know how to finalize what they're going to have. Sarah, you would do the one on hierarchical classification, dysmorphology,
yep,
behavior. Elizabeth on something related to brain and high dimensionality data from brain. Peter and or Mike, something related again to high dimensionality, large data related to face. And Tatiana, something that is at the nexus of all of those.
Okay.
I'm going to also include Ken Jones since we're doing it's dysmorphology and behavior.
Absolutely.
I appreciate that, Sarah. Thank you very much.
Mm-hmm.
And I've got your
email here. Where would the face brain stuff fit in then?
You could do face brain as a separate one. Tatiana could do something that would attempt.
I could do it more with genetics, Peter. We could definitely coordinate that. I don't think it'd be a problem.
Okay.
Yeah, maybe you can communicate a little bit offline. Before you start to write this, just to find the focus of each one.
Okay.
Kathy, are you on?
Yes, I am.
How are you?
I'm fine, thank you.
Good. We're ready for your WebEx.
Hello?
Hello?
So I just took myself off speakerphone and I lost you. Anyway, okay, so here I'm going to share my desktop. And
I think as your intro, it was nice.
There we are. Okay, can everyone see this?
Mm-hmm.
Yep.
All right, so we're going to divide my little presentation up into three subparts, one on face brain imaging and Peter, I'm assuming Mike is with you. Is that correct?
He is. I am indeed, yes.
Yes. So Mike is going to start out then talking about what he's doing with our day 10 and 11 and a half alcohol exposure. You may recall that we've already compared day 7 and 8 in mice. And then I want to talk about our drug co-exposure study, which entails looking at our synthetic cannabinoids, and then talk about what we're now doing with genetic susceptibilities and what we have planned for the future, which is to sort of go out on a limb a little bit. So we'll start out here with this with Mike, if you're ready. Here you go.
Okay, so I'm just going to just quickly go over what I've been working with Lindsay on. We're looking to basically automatically segment the mice images from chat just decimal day 17 for the
CD10 and CD11.5 alcohol exposures. So if you can move to the next slide. So what I've been doing, there's a group here at UCL, it's our medical imaging group, medical image computing group, and they've been working on some sophisticated segmentation pipelines that incorporate a lot of they basically implemented a lot of techniques that have already been in the publications to then to optimize them in a atlas-based segmentation approach. You could just click as I talk, Kathy. I think. There we go. All right. It's just
Mike, can you get closer to the speaker or something? Because you're a little bit.
Is it a bit quiet? Is that better?
That is better. Thank you.
All right. There we go. So, yeah, it's just part of the pipeline. It's generally applicable to various existing Atlas techniques, the intensity normalization, and then the brain mask. Just click, yep, and then the most computationally heavy part is the image registration. That's all fairly standard technique in the pipeline. Things like FreeSurfer adopt the same sort of approach. So that gets to us to a single atlas propagation. The difference with this technique that the UCL employs, they use a multi-atlas method, and I know there are a lot of other ones out there as well. And what this multi-atlas procedure does is it works to use several training images to then to optimize the segmentation. So what you then get as a result of this is the most optimized version of the segmentation. So if you can click to the next slide. And the results of this is one that's just I had this morning done. If you click again there, Kathy, you can see that we've ended up with our 25. Too quick.
Sorry, I'll go back.
So we've been segmenting into 25 anatomical components of the mice. And if you click again, convert this into 3D. This is the manual version of the segmentation, and if we just click one more time, we've now got the automated version of the same segmentation, so it's very similar, it's maybe a bit more, maybe a bit smoother, less rigid. We're getting rid of a lot of noise actually in these, so that's a good thing. So this can be applied, click. What we're going to do then is then apply it in the same way we did in the plus one paper, the components with the face. And then we can throw it into our software as well. And if you click to the next slide, so our progress so far is Lindsay and I have been working to kind of optimize this. It's taken longer than we intended, but we've so far got 70 successfully segmented. There's 40 currently running, another 35 ready to go into it. Just one more click, and I think we're done. And of course, this technique is also applicable to any MRI imager, so it's the human, fish, anything. So I've been sort of experimenting and playing with it and seeing what we can get out of it, really. It's quite a good, useful, automated technique to use, basically. And I think that's me done.
All right. Thanks, Mike. That's pretty cool, song and dance from one side of the Atlantic to the other, huh? Anyway, okay, so now I want to talk a little bit about our synthetic cannabinoid teratogenicity study. We're just doing the baseline work now so that we can start to do co-exposures with alcohol, and you may recall that Dr. Koob was quite excited about this at our last face-to-face meeting. I think partly because of the interest in sort of combining some efforts with NIAAA and NIDA. So just to refresh your memory, marijuana is the most widely used illicit drug by pregnant women in the world. That the potency of what we all think of as marijuana, that is Delta-9 THC, has increased a lot since the 1970s. And now that there are a lot of very highly potent synthetic cannabinoids, and their use is increasing as they're not policed very well, partly because they keep changing. They keep making new ones, and it's very hard to detect, come up with methods for detecting blood levels, et cetera. So we started out with one of these synthetic cannabinoids that we could get without having a drug license, which we're now getting so that we can test a lot of other ones, and started out with a dosage that we expected might be teratogenic because it was a really high dose. And with that very high dose, indeed, we saw a lot of abnormalities, and we were dosing on our standard alcohol exposure time to get the FAS face, and that was day 7 in the mouse. We use an eye scoring scale, as you see on the bottom, to document the severity of the insult, and then we can readily compare our control and our alcohol exposed or our cannabinoid exposed animals. We were concerned because the defects that we were seeing, we weren't sure were specific to the drug itself or to the abnormal physiology that we were creating in the mothers. In particular, they got kind of cold. So Marcota Gilbert, who is actually doing this work with supplement money from the consortium, did rectal temperature tracking on these animals. It might sound a little icky, huh? Anyway, and indeed the temperature was dropping a lot in the 2 milligram per kilogram treated animals. We then heated these animals. We put them on a warming pad and got their body temperatures up to normal, and still got abnormalities that way. And we've been testing other dosages more recently. We've dropped the level to 1 milligram per kilogram and then again down to 0.5 milligrams per kilogram. And at these lower doses, we don't see the temperature dropping like we did with the 2 gram per kilogram dose. Also, for this type of study, it's really important to know that we're causing teratogenic effects and not necessarily lethal effects. We want to know that our litter sizes are pretty much normal, and at all the doses that we're testing, in fact, we're not killing many, many pups. We have a very, very low lethality. We've been happy to see that we can, in fact, back the dose down a lot and still see significantly greater incidence of abnormalities. So we're now at a 0.5 milligram dose and seeing a lot of eye defects in both the right and left eyes of our treated animals as compared to vehicle treated controls. We're backing the dose down another half step, and that is currently in progress, and we're also working on a methodology to determine the maternal plasma levels so that we know what the maternal concentration is. So these are all really important baseline studies that we have to do before we start the alcohol exposure. What we see are some really interesting types of birth defects with even the lower doses of the cannabinoids. And what you're looking at here are histological sections through some near-term mouse fetuses on the left. You're just seeing three different levels of coronal sections through one animal on the left, our control. And you see that it's at the bottom one is through the brain, and you can see that it's through the anterior commissure. In the middle one, you can see it's through the palate, and you can see that the palatal shelves, which are right above the tongue, are closed. Maybe you can see my pointer there. So there's the palate. It's closed. Nice anterior commissure here. With the septal region and the fornices coming down here. This is one with a 1 milligram per kilogram treatment, and we see a very obvious wide cleft palate with exposure on day 8, and that's the time we've chosen to look at with this treatment regimen. And we see a really abnormal looking brain. It's even hard to describe. It's so weird. So but we know we're at the same level as our control. These are two different animals that were treated with our lowest dose. this animal had an oblique facial cleft. It's a really rare type of defect, and accompanying that oblique facial cleft is a cleft palate. I want to mention that these animals, although they have a baseline incidence of ocular abnormalities, you never see a cleft palate in a C57 black mouse in a control. It just doesn't happen. So we know our drug is making it. And in these brains, they're both some version of holoprosencephaly, this one an obvious one. This one, I don't know, it might be a little hard to say exactly what that is, but it did have this very common connection between the ventricles. So we're seeing lots of good defects, and we're getting our dosage down to what is what we think is pretty realistic. And next step is to start combining that with alcohol, and so we'll keep you posted on what we find. The next thing I'd like to talk about is our genetic susceptibility study, and we're branching out. So our most recent publication on this was one in which we were using haploinsufficient mice, mice that were heterozygous either for a hedgehog or a GLE2 knockout. And with this exposure paradigm, we take a mutant mouse and made it to a wild type animal, and then the litter has half mutant animals and half wild types. And so when you treat the mother with alcohol, all the pups are exposed at the same time to the same dosage, and then you can compare and see if the incidence and severity differ in your heterozygous versus your wild type animals. And in fact, we found that with a day 7 exposure, we had a lot more severe and frequently occurring craniofacial abnormalities in both of these knockout animals. So we decided that we want to get into this genetic susceptibility business in a bigger way, so sort of jumping in with both feet. And so I thought this Mark Twain quote was sort of appropriate for today. Why not go out on a limb? That's where the fruit is. And in fact, we're going out on a limb because for a long time we've known that alcohol can also cause limb defects, and it causes a very specific pattern. And it's very easy to quantify the types of defects that alcohol causes in a limb because it's pretty easy to count fingers. It also happens when the embryo is at an older stage, so it makes it much more readily dealt with, both histologically. If you want to lop off the affected area, it's much easier to do that. Also, there's a lot known in developmental biology about what controls patterning in the limb and the timing that's critical, et cetera. So this just shows an example of what alcohol can do to the outgrowing limb instead of having these nice 5 digits like in our hand with this being the thumb. We lose postaxial digits, so we typically lose the little finger and a lot of times the ring finger as well. We know that that digit specification is dependent on hedgehog signaling, and we know that the fifth digit requires both the longest in duration amount of hedgehog as well as the highest amount of the protein to cause a little finger. The ring finger is next in requiring a moderate amount of expression and duration, and the middle finger is next. From a study that graduate student did in my lab and published in 2007, we were able to show that with alcohol exposure on day 9 1/4, if we look by day 10, when the limb bud has gotten out here, and here you can see the periphery of the outgrowing limb bud, this is where hedgehog should be expressed in a very bright, distinct area here at the postaxial side of the limb bud. And in our alcohol-exposed animals, that expression was very, very much reduced. So we certainly anticipated that in our haploinsufficient hedgehog mice that we would see that they were more vulnerable to alcohol-induced limb reduction defects than than the wild type animals. And that is indeed what Eric Fish, working on these animals, has shown us, and he's come up with a nice scoring system for the digit defects, because, in fact, it is a little more complicated than just missing one or two digits. You get some sort of little dangling digits that are too little, but they're still there, et cetera. So he has developed a nice scoring system and shown us basically the same thing in these animals for the limb as we saw for the face. And as I said, that's not surprising. And we also expect that the GLE2 animals, which is a downstream event in the hedgehog pathway, would be similarly affected, and that study will be done. So we know a lot about what hedgehog does in the limb and the downstream pathways that are required for digit specification. We also know quite a lot about what happens upstream of hedgehog. For example, a gene called HAND2, which is not only expressed in the hand, it's expressed in other areas like the heart and the brain, is critical for turning on hedgehog in the developing limb. And when Corey did his study and looked just within 12 hours after his alcohol exposure, he found that hand, too, wasn't there. So that's an upstream event, and we certainly expect that if this gene were mutated, that it also would result in greater vulnerability to alcohol-induced limb defects. This shows you what's upstream of HAND2. And so HAND2, we remember, is required for turning on hedgehog, but what's upstream of that? HOX9. That should also give us greater vulnerability. And what's upstream of HOX9? Retinoic acid. The retinoic acid expression has been known for a long time to be key to turning on hedgehog signaling through this pathway. We know that retinoic acid is produced in the somites in the intermediate mesoderm here, and that is what's required for initiation of limb outgrowth. In fact, at the time that the embryos are most sensitive to being affected by alcohol to giving us limb defects is when the embryo is at this stage, at day 9.25, when it has about 20 somites. It's at this stage that the alcohol caused the defect, not at the time when hedgehog starts to be expressed. So that argues that, in fact, what alcohol is doing, at least initially, is working very upstream of hedgehog signaling. A long time ago, Duster and some of his colleagues out in Colorado suggested that, in fact, the teratogenesis of alcohol is a result of alcohol competitively inhibiting the synthesis of retinoic acid, because both ethanol and retinol require aldehyde dehydrogenase for their pathway. Brain freeze here. Anyway, you know what I'm saying. So retinoic acid is known to be required for forelimb induction. It's interesting, though, that it isn't required for the hind limb. And when we treat animals with alcohol, even if we treat them later at a time when that corresponds to the forelimb development, hind limb's a little bit behind in development, we can't make limb defects involving the hind limb. And that also argues very strongly that retinoic acid reduction might be sort of the key initial player in this pathway. But we're very biased, so we keep stringing together all of our ideas, and they may all be very legitimate and accurate, but we might be missing things because we're pretty biased that's the pathway that is the key one. So we're always looking for new technologies that we can apply to our problems, and we've realized that RNA sequencing might be very well applied to our questions, because it allows you to look at all of the RNAs that are present at any one given moment in time. And what we're proposing to do, and in fact starting to do, is to clip off the developing limb bud tissue, and we can get tiny, tiny amounts out and get enough RNA to do the RNA-seq procedure on. We can look at times that are upstream of hedgehog signaling and times that are downstream of hedgehog signaling. We can see what genes are most affected by the alcohol exposure. We can then go back to our knockout animals, just like we have with the hedgehog and the glea knockouts, and test the results to see if, in fact, the animals whose genes were identified from the RNA-seq are more sensitive to alcohol teratogenicity. And so we're pretty excited about this approach, and would be interested to see what you think about our ideas. So that's what I had to say today. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Kathy. those are three very different but exciting opportunities. I wanted to ask you about what the, to you and Mike, what the automated segmentation will add that programs like BeeSurfer don't already provide.
In terms of the improvement on FreeSurfer, it's literally just a more optimized approach. It works in a very similar way for the multi-atlas. It's just another way of doing it, really.
Thank you.
And also that we have the support of our people pretty much on the site. So anything when we're doing it, we've got that support here. So it kind of helps us quite a lot.
And Kathy, have you talked to Tatiana about checking for either of the, Sonic Hedgehog or Lee 2 in the CFAS population? Have you begun to?
We haven't. No, we haven't. And so I'm listening to this, and actually I was looking at the RNA-seq. One of the things we talked about was trying to look at some of the ciliopathies, and we've been sort of overwhelmed by who to do it in and how many genes we'd have to look through in order to explore that. But if we have a more limited number of genes, we certainly could look a little bit at that. I just wanted to comment that I really love the idea of the RNA sequencing. I think it's a really powerful way to go, and I think it's really appropriate in your model, Kathy, and I think that's going to be really interesting data.
Thank you. We're excited about it.
I think you should be. I think you're going to have some really interesting things. I don't know what you'll find, but I think it'll be really interesting.
I know. It's going to be good.
I think something for us to talk through, not today because there's not much time, but certainly at our next face-to-face and maybe even before then, we're not going to have our face-to-face for a while, is how to refine the questions that we're going to ask of the genetic sample that will be growing in the coming months. There are so many different directions that we could take, and Peter had a wonderful idea on our call not so long ago about also looking at phenocopies of fetal alcohol to see if we pick up any of the genes that are abnormal in those. And Peter, maybe you can just take a moment to expound on your idea.
Well, it was stimulated by what you said about, in a sense you'd look at a phenocopy of a brain effect. And I thought, well, why don't we look at phenocopies of philtrum effects? And so, a condition like Williams syndrome has a long philtrum, which often is smooth. And so should we look at 7q11, 22, is it 3, for some candidates, for instance? It was just off the top of my head.
Yeah, but it's kind of an interesting idea. Now, what hasn't panned out, the phenocopy that we looked at, of course, was L1 gene mutations in humans where there was some overlap in brain. But it turns out that L1 itself isn't as interesting in the population, but that pathways that regulate L1 are turning out to be more interesting. So With any one of these phenocopies, it could be the gene itself or it could be regulators of the gene, much as Kathy's just shown now with the whole pathway leading from retinoic acid to sonic hedgehog and its signaling. So there's an awful lot to look at, and of course, what I've learned from my discussions with Tatiana and Leah is that the more these things you look at, the less power you have to find effects. So it would behoove us to begin to come up with a strategy for how to query the genetic database that we're building in the way that will prove most effective.
I would agree, and actually that might be something. I don't necessarily want to wait that long. I know we've got presenting in January. I think that at that point we could certainly describe the sample that's been sent off for GWAS, and I think it's a really important topic. I think I am conservative in the sense that the more testing we do, the more at some point we've got to begin to correct, and we're looking at a lot of phenotypes, and the sample size is modest. But I think that's where some of these multivariate approaches would really buy us back a lot of power.
So what Tatiana is referring to is in part that, you know, if we have 10 different facial phenotypes and we compare each one, we get hundreds or thousands of comparisons that need post-hoc corrections. But if we come up with the sort of universal integrated phenotype that has as a principal component elements of brain, face, and behavior, you're only doing one comparison. The analogy that we talked about was you could look at 10 components of an IQ test and look for correlations with each one, or you could simply look at IQ and see how well that correlates. And that's very much what Peter's been doing in his principal components derived from face and from philtrum. Maybe what we can consider doing for January is having your presentation and then devoting significant time to talking about how to utilize the genetic information that we're collecting, because I think it impacts on Kathy's project, on mine, on Johan's, and I think Peter's idea is also well worth testing. And I'm sure there are others, as we reflect, that will also come up in this. So I think it's very timely, and, we're sort of poised to be able to do some of those higher-order principal components.
I totally agree. I think that'll be a great use of the January call. I think between Peter and us, we'll certainly fill the hour. Yeah.
And it'll prepare us also for our talks in March, and we'll probably have time to to incubate more ideas after that. So let's plan to do that for January.
Great.
Jill, in the remaining time, do you want to cover some of the logistics related to the meeting? Just tell us where we are.
We are at a couple of folks have let me know that those dates do not work for them. Dr. Jones is going to be giving a talk that Wednesday in Irvine, so he wouldn't be able to fly out until Thursday. And I know there were a couple of other conflicts for March as well. So I went ahead and pulled for April just to see if we can hit a date that works better for everyone. I pulled for February and March previously, and you guys are just all so successful and busy that it's hard to get 3 days to pull you away from your lives. So I've pulled another doodle poll together. If March still ends up being the one that we can hit the most people, then we'll go with that and work with it the best we can. But I went ahead and wanted us to look at April, and if you guys can respond by Monday, I can take a quick look and let you guys know. That's where we're at with that. Does that help at all?
It does. Thank you. So everybody, please fill out the doodle poll in the coming days. And
please continue to hold the March dates just so we have something set. And it is March and April, so we're not going to get the sweet January hotel deal that we always used to get, but they do have availability for us, so that's a good thing. And then the other quick thing that I had was just Ed had received a request from someone to share a request for dysmorphology data. And I know the data access policy is getting worked on, and I read through it last night, and there's talks of there being an application online. Do you need me to start working on an application? Do you want me to prepare that? What can I do?
So this is Bill. That would be great. So what we have is a policy, but what we will ultimately need to, as part of policy to share data would be a data use agreement, and I was waiting to start on that until we had the policy done, because otherwise I'd be chasing my tail.
Yeah, so, I agree. So we can do a quick Google form whenever you have the questions ready. I'm happy to do the Google form, or they're quite easy. It makes it sound like I'm a rocket scientist when I say I do the Google form, but really anyone could do them. So if you need help, let me know. They're easy to share between each other.
Yeah, that's kind of the middle part is we have the policy now. We'll need to have people submit applications, and then to release data, we should have a data use agreement. What we can do is use this request to develop that agreement.
Okay, so as far as what I should let this party know to do is that we're going to be having a form that they need to fill out, and even if we don't have the Google form ready, maybe we could just get those questions so I could email them to them to get the process started. Is that cool?
That's right, and I don't know that we have those questions, things you would have to answer. It's kind of implied by the policy, but I don't think we've laid it out explicitly.
Well, maybe would it be possible for those questions to be generated by next week?
I think
possibly.
So. But what do my fellows on the Data Access Committee think?
Yes.
Okay, great. Well, I'm taking an actual vacation tomorrow and Friday, but I'll be back in the office Monday. I'm going to the lovely city of Austin, Texas, with some college girlfriends for a 20-year reunion.
Awesome.
So I will look at it again on Monday, but if you could let me know, that'd be awesome.
Okay, thanks. You bet.
Jill, real quick, Scott. In terms of the meeting, it might shift in dates, but have you looked into availability of our room here by any chance?
I didn't, because part of our great rate has to do with us buying some food from the Hilton. So, but when we know the actual days, we can always compare and see if using that room is better. I don't go to the meetings. So do both rooms work well for you guys, or is there a preference to the NIAAA room?
We'll probably have different opinions, but I think there's better functionality here in our building. It seemed like we had some audio issues and some projection issues when we...
We did. Okay. Oh, that's good to know.
Something to think about.
Because we can always, you know, pay an extra $10 a night for the sleeping rooms and use the NIAAA space. So can you and I'll send an email to you, and you can put me in touch with the right person to check again. Is that okay?
Absolutely.
Okay, thanks.
All right. Are there any other issues in the last minute? If not, thank you all, and look forward to hearing your voices again next month.
Awesome. Thank you, Dr. Charnas.
Okay, bye-bye.
Thank you.